If things go as I expect them to go, somewhere during our class this evening, I'll have some handouts. So whoever wants to volunteer at that time, just be prepared. So last week, we looked at the manuscript evidence for the integrity of the text of the Gospels. And we saw that by the measure that historians use, the Gospels pass the test. In fact, they pass them to a degree that no other ancient work does, by a factor of 3+. So to call into question the integrity of the Gospel text would be to call into question all of classical ancient history, something no reasonable nor reputable scholar is going to do. So we can be confident we have a reliable representation of what Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John intended for us to have. The question before us this evening is, some skeptics question not the integrity of the text, but its believability. They argue, well, you may well have what Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John wrote, but what you've got are carefully copied frauds. The Gospels are so steeped in bias, they are so full of contradictions and discrepancies and outlandish and unrealistic claims, they were never worthy of trust to begin with. So what do we say to that? Are they right? Well, I think I know what you believe because you're sitting here this evening. But I will admit, some of the things that some of these detractors bring forward at first are fairly compelling. They seem very compelling. But I also remember Proverbs 18:17. What did Solomon tell us? The first one to plead his cause seems right until what? His neighbor comes and examines it. And isn't that the truth of things? You hear something presented for the first time, and you think, oh. And then someone comes along and puts that in its proper context and brings more information to bear on that information. You're like, oh, that's not exactly as it seemed. And I think it's that way with all of these things they bring to bear. And we're not going to try to cover all of them, but we're looking tonight, next week, and maybe even to the following week at this internal evidence. What do we have within the text of the Gospels themselves, which would indicate to us, apart from anything external, even if we didn't know anything about the manuscript evidence and the archaeological things which we may be looking at later, is there anything in the text themselves that if we were on a desert island, had never been exposed to this before, and we picked it up, would indicate to us that this is reliable history? Well, the answer is yes. So let's start with the issue of bias. About a little over 20 years ago, there was a so-called documentary that was presented on cable television about Jesus. And it began with this statement by the narrator, quote, "Most of what we think we know about Jesus comes from the New Testament Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But we can't trust those books for accurate information because they were written by the converted." Which is to say, of course, they were written by people who were interested parties, who were believers, who were biased, who had an agenda, and therefore they cannot be trusted. Well, let me ask you, were Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John biased? Okay, I see a bunch of heads nodding. And it kind of depends on what we mean by bias, doesn't it? So I didn't use Google. I went to my New World Dictionary that was probably published back in the 80s or something. But here's what it says. Bias, a mental leaning or inclination. Partiality, I don't think they were that. Prejudiced, I don't think they were that. Bent, maybe. They certainly were converted. They were not neutral concerning the claims of Christ. They were believers, and guess what? They wanted you and me to be as well. Did they have agendas? Has anybody here ever read a book about archery or baseball or cooking or anything else? And who wrote that book? I'm not looking for a name, but who wrote that book? Oh, yeah, someone who believes in the value of that thing. Someone who's very biased toward that thing. It's the people who believe in the value of a thing who write the information to pass it on to others. So it shouldn't surprise us. It shouldn't surprise us at all. It makes perfect sense that the primary vehicle for information about Jesus Christ would come to us from people of this kind. That's in perfect keeping. That's the way almost everything is. They did have agendas. Luke chapter 1, beginning in verse 3, Luke told us what his was. He said to Theophilus, "It seemed good to me to write to you an orderly account that you may know the certainty of those things in which you were instructed." I know you were told about the Christian religion. I know you were told about Jesus Christ, Theophilus. I'm writing to you an orderly account so that you can know the truth of those things. My goal is for you to feel assured and certain of what you've been taught already. John had an agenda. John chapter 20, verses 30 and 31. Truly, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written. Why? That you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. So notice that. They had an agenda, and they were upfront with it. We are believers, and we wish you to be as well. We know these things are true. We want you to know these things are true. And on this issue of it being written by the converted, I'm just going to take a brief detour here for a moment. You know, arguing that the Gospels can't be trusted because they're written by the converted misses a very important question. Why were they converted? Did these men pay a price for their conversion? They most certainly did. An enormous one, a higher one than anyone in this room has ever paid. Now, some of us have maybe paid some of the price some of those men paid. But I don't know if there's no one in this room who's paid the price that some of them did. These men abandoned their livelihoods. They abandoned treasured religious traditions. They abandoned relationships. Because why? They wanted power over the people. This is what some say. Well, what power did they gain? Well, they didn't gain any. By asserting that Jesus Christ had risen from the dead, they got persecution, they got torture, and some of them got martyrdom. So the gospel writers had every earthly motive to keep their pens in their pockets and their lips shut about the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And yet, they proclaimed it in pen and in word. So that's an important question. Does that all by itself prove anything? No, because are there people who have converted to things that are false at great cost to themselves? There are. And as we look at this information tonight, I think we need to think of it in a cumulative way. Each little piece, all by itself, may not prove anything. But when you take it all together, where does the preponderance of the evidence lead us? These men converted for some reason at great cost to themselves, and they continue to teach these things at great cost to themselves. And yes, they had some bias. But the mere fact that a writer wants to prove something does not make that writer unreliable. If it does, then every book written by an atheist to affirm atheism is to be completely disregarded, dismissed right out of hand. Oh, you're only writing that because you want me to believe it, so we're going to dismiss that. We don't do that. If an innocent man is accused of a crime, he's an innocent man, he's accused of a crime, he is brought to the witness stand, does he have an agenda? He most certainly does. He is deeply interested in convincing you that he is not guilty. Does that mean his testimony is false? Obviously not. So once again, having a bias, having an agenda is not a reason to dismiss evidence. Holocaust is another example. These people who've written the accounts of the Holocaust, why did they write those? Why have the survivors of the Holocaust, which probably aren't very many living now, but why did they write down the things they did? Why did they tell us about it? There it is. They want us to remember this so that it won't happen again, hopefully. They've got an agenda. They've got a bias. But do we dismiss their testimony? No, in fact, we rely upon it. This is a very important point. People can be objective even when they're not neutral. So I don't know about you, but I can get bamboozled sometimes. I'm not very quick on my feet sometimes. People will throw a piece of information at me or an argument at me, and I don't know what to do with it. And sometimes they can say things, and I think, well, but you start thinking about these things. Don't let yourself be bamboozled or discouraged or dissuaded by arguments like that. They are empty. A doctor can give an objective diagnosis even if he has strong feelings for the patient. In fact, those strong feelings for the patient may lead him to what? Be all the more careful and all the more meticulous. Passion will lead some people to exaggerate and not be careful. It will lead others to be more meticulous, more accurate. So the question again before us tonight is not whether the gospel writers had an agenda. It's did they report accurately, and what in the text would indicate to us that they did. Well, we're going to go through a number of things. Let's just start out with the style in which the Gospels were written. Tim.
So, was there any writing that we could consider not biased?
Some news outlets would like us to believe so.
Talk about for the Gospels, were they, what did you in your study see anything that uncovered that might have been written that would have been unbiased or that weren't per se?
Now, you're speaking within Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John?
Well, for the Bible itself, or, you know, we look at that. But the Gospels are the topic here, so that would have confirmed the bias of them. I mean, confirmed.
Okay, are you asking if there are other pieces of evidence, say other writings and so forth, outside of the Bible that would confirm
the
testimony?
From other people who would have written history.
Yes, there are, and that's going to be under the external evidence test, which will start in a couple weeks.
I just want to make sure you knew that.
Yeah, appreciate that. Thank you. Yeah, we're taking this piece by piece. So we've established the integrity of the text. We've got what they wrote. Now we're looking within the text to see if it bears the marks of credible history, and then we're going to look at outside of the text and look at things out that are not even from Christians, which do confirm the accurate testimony of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So it's an excellent question. We'll get there in time, Lord willing. Are there any other questions or comments? Okay. I like what one writer said about the Gospels. He wrote, quote, that the narratives are vivid, but they are uncluttered. They are full of incidental details. And you notice that. We take these things for granted, but you're reading the Gospels, and there's all sorts of things about how many, how far, what the name of this thing was. There's a lot of just little incidental details thrown in there like you and I would use if we were telling a story. It doesn't sound artificial. It doesn't sound superficial. They're full of ordinary people, psychological realism. I can relate to the people in this book, to my shame, much of the time. But I can relate to them. The narratives are restrained. They understate the sensational. What do I mean by that? If someone had invented Christianity and invented the whole person of Jesus Christ, which there is a very small but a vocal minority of people who believe that, they're called mythicists, and we'll probably get to them a couple weeks or so, maybe three, and they believe the whole idea of Jesus is false. There was never a single individual who matched the biblical description in any way, shape, or form. That he was just eventually created over time, and Christians later on would refer back to him as if he was real, but he never was real to begin with. But if I were inventing what happened with Jesus, if I was just completely pulling it out of my mind, and I was writing it for the purpose, as people suppose, to try to gain a following and to create a religion. So I want something that people are going to buy. I want something that people are going to be attracted to. I want something that people are going to be excited by and so forth. When I came to the crucifixion, number one, I wouldn't even bring crucifixion into it, which we'll get to in time. But let's say I make the bad decision to involve crucifixion in this religion I'm inventing. When it came time to describe Jesus' crucifixion, what would I write? What would you include? The gospel writers, I looked through it today. All four of them, here's what they say. And they crucified him. Period. There are no gory details. There's none of the sensationalizing that we would certainly find in a novel and we would expect in a man-made book. They're very much like this all throughout the Gospels. Matthew, even though he's one of the longer Gospels, condenses narratives all the time. It's just the facts. Why are they written in that sober, matter-of-fact, non-sensational way? Well, it reads as if they're just trying to tell us what happened. So, does that all by itself prove to us these books are reliable? No, but it's part of the puzzle. They also included an awful lot of inconvenient information. There is, in historiography, what's called the principle or criterion of embarrassment. And according to this principle, this is how they view it. An historical account is more likely to be true if it includes embarrassing or damaging details about the heroic figures or the person giving the account. In other words, the sort of stories that we invent about ourselves or the sort of stories that we exaggerate are the stories that tend to make us look what? Better, right. And if I want to sell you on an idea, I'm going to highlight the good stuff. So we have Matthew and John, who are themselves apostles. And as we go through the Gospels, and Mark appears to have gotten his information from Peter, we have multiple people in the second century testifying to this. Here's the sorts of things they tell us about themselves. Three times during Jesus' ministry, these men are jockeying for position. They thought Jesus was going to set up an earthly kingdom, so that means there's going to be a minister of state, there's going to be a treasury secretary, blah, 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 and they wanted the best spots. Three times we see them arguing. In the first case, they're on the road arguing about it when Jesus is not hearing them, they think. And then when they get into the house, Jesus says, "What were you arguing about on the road?" And what do? They don't answer. And why don't they answer? Because they're embarrassed. They know they shouldn't be having that kind of argument. This is very childish behavior. Why is this included? These are the holy apostles. This is the foundation of the church. Why are the writers including this? In the second case, James and John's mom gets involved. And then in the third case, it appears they may have even been doing it in the upper room after the Lord's Supper and the Passover has been observed. And even if they hadn't started it in the upper room, Jesus feels the need to address it in the upper room. When he's just told them, one of you is going to betray me, when he knows he's going to be killed the next day, he's got all these things in their mind, and he's having to address these children, like me, about this silly argument they've been having about who's going to be the greatest. Why is stuff like that included? When the group comes with Judas that night to Gethsemane, Jesus had told them, "Strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered." Matthew 26:56, "Then all the disciples forsook him and fled." Why is all the information given to us about Peter? Does Peter, let me ask you, we have people in the world, many of them today, who believe, of course, that Peter was the first pope. The Bible does not teach that. That's not true. And yet, did Peter hold a prominent place among the apostles? I see some head nods. Why? Why would we say that? And I see some people looking at me going, "Oh, I'm not so sure about that." All right, he was a bold spokesman. He was inclined to talk. And there's a reason. There's a use for that. The Lord had a use for that. What was it you said, Jerry? Right, so there's this inner circle that Jesus took apart with him three times. And Peter was one of those. Well, yeah, he's one of the authors of the New Testament. The first 10 chapters of the book of Acts highlight who? Peter. Who's the first in every list of the apostles we have? Peter. Who's the only one Jesus gave a new name? You say, well, he gave James and John, the sons of Boanerges, the sons of thunder. Yeah, but that's kind of a group name. He only gave one man a brand new personal name. That was Peter. Yes, Peter does hold a prominent place. He was a leader. And the Lord made use of that. So here's this man who played a very important role in God's work. And how do the Gospels depict this man? Matthew 17, the tax collectors come along who collect the temple tax. And they say, "Doesn't your master pay the tax?" Peter goes, "Yeah." But he doesn't really know that. He goes in the house and the Lord preempts him and has a little conversation with him and teaches him a lesson. Why, even though I'm not accountable for paying it, I will go ahead and pay it so we don't cause them to stumble. Talking before he'd thought. On the Sea of Galilee, he falls flat on his face. And I would have done the same. I never would have even gotten out on the water. So we do see some good. I remember when Bethany was little. Of course, I think Zion had maybe been born, so our oldest three, and they all had biblical names. And, you know, when you're a little child, your sphere of experience is about as big as your family. So in Bethany's experience, everybody, you know, all children have names after Bible figures. Well, she's got this little doll or whatever that she's decided to name Little Faith. And I hear her talking to herself in the back of the van. She goes, "Oh, well, that's not a name from the Bible. Oh, wait. Oh, you have Little Faith." So there you go. But Peter is the one who's told this. He falls flat on his face. For a moment, he's doing the unsinkable, but then he looks at the waves, he gets caught up in the storm, and he's crying out to the Lord. This does not make him look very good. On the Mount of Transfiguration, "Lord, let's build these three tabernacles." And Mark tells us that, why did he say that? He didn't know what to say. Well, James and John are thinking there's no need to say anything. But Peter felt the need to speak. That was one of his failings, and he, I think, surely got better at that. He has the audacity to take the Lord aside and say, "Oh, no, you're not going to die at Jerusalem. Not so, Lord." And Mark tells us that Jesus literally turns away from Peter, toward the other disciples. So it appears he turns his back to Peter, and what's he say? Get behind me, Satan. Why is information like this included? Simon, are you sleeping? Could you not pray? Could you not watch 1 hour? He denies the Lord 3 times. He said, oh no, I won't do it. I'll go with you both to prison of death. Though all are made to stumble, I won't be made to stumble. And then when he's asked about it the first time, he gets worse every time. The first time is like, I don't know what you're talking about. Then the second time, no, I don't know him. And then the third time, he starts cursing and swearing. Swearing by what, you wonder? And what were his cursings? He's bringing imprecations down upon himself to try to be more convincing. This makes Peter look very bad. Why are these things included? Why are we told about doubting Thomas? Here we are 2,000 years later, and he's still known by this. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. Thomas. And then throughout Mark, what do we see? The apostles are hard-hearted. Jesus feeds the 5,000, and then he sends the apostles. He tells them to get in the boat and get out on the water that night. He meets them out on the water. He's walking on the water, and then he calms the sea. And when he gets in the boat, it says the apostles were astonished beyond measure. And we are told in Mark 6, verse 52, for they had not understood about the loaves because their heart was hardened. The holy apostles were hard-hearted. They hadn't put the pieces together. And it's brought out again in Mark 8, 17. The apostles now, they've seen Jesus feed the 5,000. They've seen him feed the 4,000. And one day they get in the boat and they didn't get enough bread. They only had 1 loaf. Jesus gets in the boat and he says, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. And the apostles say to themselves, he's saying it because we didn't bring enough food. And Jesus looks at him and says, when I fed the 5,000, how many leftovers were there? How many baskets of leftovers? 12. When I fed the 4,000, how many baskets full of leftovers were there? 7. And then Jesus says to them, why do you reason because you have no bread? Do you not yet perceive nor understand? Is your heart still hardened? And then in the 16th chapter, he's rebuking them again because of their hardness of heart. Why are details like this included? Again, all by itself, does this prove anything? And you might say, well, you know, if I was trying to craft a narrative, I want to make it as believable as possible, so I'm going to intentionally include some of these bad things to make it believable. Yeah, but this many? And we haven't plunged the depths of it yet. Well, these are legends that collected around the apostles over time, John. Well, if they're legends, which direction do legends normally go? Do they go in the positive direction? Father, yes, I cut down the cherry tree. I cannot tell a lie. Well, that never happened. But it was one of these legends that grew up around George Washington. Historical figures tend to become more heroic over time, not less. So what do the inclusion of all these things tell us? It tells us, number one, that they were trying to write real history. And number two, that these things were written at a very early date because the apostasy puts the holy apostles up on a huge pedestal and they would not have written things like this in all likelihood. But that we're still not done. The Son of God in the Gospels is said to be a Jew from Nazareth of Galilee. Now, you and I are so used to this, it doesn't even register on our radar. But the gospel was to take root in first century Palestine. And in first century Palestine, how was Galilee and Nazareth viewed? Are you also a Galilean? Can anything good come out of Nazareth? Galilean was a derogatory term used in the Roman Empire. In the second century, Celsus is quoted in Origen. He's writing, and here's what he had to say about Jews. Those Jews who cower together in a corner of Palestine. And you, do you not believe that the Son of God sent to the Jews is the most ridiculous makeshift of all? If I were trying to invent a religion, if I were inventing a story that's not real, I would certainly not have started with a Jew from Nazareth in Galilee. And I certainly would not have him be crucified. What did Paul say about this? But we preach Christ crucified, to the Jews a stumbling block, and to the Greeks, foolishness. Among the Romans, crucifixion was afflicted on the lower classes above all. on slaves, violent criminals, unruly elements in the rebellious provinces, those who accused of treason. They had phrases for the cross. It was the infamous stake, the criminal wood, the terrible cross from the 3rd century BC onward. So we're going 200 years plus before Jesus is born onward. There's evidence that the word cross was a vulgar taunt among the lower classes. Lucian of Samosata, who wrote in the 2nd century, he was a satirist. In other words, he made his living by making fun of things. We have people like that today. And we have his work called The Death of Peregrine, and he's making fun of Christians. And he makes fun of Christians by, among other things, making fun of Christ. And he speaks of Christ this way: the distinguished personage who was crucified, the crucified sage. Justin Martyr, who wrote in the 2nd century, I know I'm throwing a lot out, but hang with me here. Justin Martyr wrote in the 2nd century, he was a believer, and here's what he said of those who were against Christianity. He say, they say that our madness, the Greek word is mania, M-A-N-I-A, they think we are maniacs. They say that our madness consists in the fact that we put a crucified man in second place after the unchangeable and eternal God, the creator of the world. It's very difficult, I think, to get ourselves into that world because we weren't there. But the idea of the Son of God coming to Israel among Jews and then being crucified was absolute insanity to the 1st and 2nd century Roman world. And yet that's the story they told. Why would you choose that story? Unless it was real history you were interested in. And why would you say that the first people to discover the empty tomb were women? Why would you say that the first person to whom the Son of God appeared after his resurrection was a woman? Why would you say that the first ones to go back to the men, the apostles, and tell them that Jesus had risen from the dead were women, and then the apostles are rebuked when they don't believe them? You say, well, I don't see what's such a big deal about that. Josephus was born into that world. He was a first century Jewish man. He was born about 37-38 AD, so just a few years after Jesus' crucifixion. He was born into a priestly family. He was a Pharisee by the age of 19. In his book, Antiquities of the Jews, which many of you probably have at home, not the most riveting reading in the world, but it's a good resource. He, in book 4 of his work, is telling the Gentile world about the Jewish people, and he's telling them about the law that Moses received. And he's condensing it and breaking it down so that the Gentiles, the Romans, can hear about what the Jews believed and what they were told. And here is what he said concerning the law. But let not a single witness be credited, but three, or two at the least. Now, that sounds familiar, doesn't it? By the mouth of two or three witnesses, let every word be established. So, in Jewish jurisprudence, let not a single witness be credited, but three or two at the least, and those whose testimony is confirmed by their good lives. But let not the testimony of women be admitted on account of the levity and boldness of their sex. I'm thankful for the testimony of women. They've helped me a lot. But this is showing us the scribe, Pharisee, first century view of the law. It appears that Jewish women were not even allowed to testify in court. So here you have Matthew, Mark, and John, Jewish men in Palestine, writing for an audience that is, the gospel, of course, begins right there in Jerusalem, spreads through the Jewish world, then into the Gentile world. And they're making women the star of the show, part, of course, from the Lord. Abdu Murray, a man with Middle Eastern roots in Lebanon, writes the following. The Bible records that the first people to lay eyes on Jesus' resurrected body were women. This isn't a mere scrap of narrative detail. In the first century Middle East, a woman's testimony was worth half that of a man, if it was worth anything at all. Yet the gospel message that Jesus had risen from the dead and was meant to take root in Yet the gospel message that Jesus had risen from the dead was meant to take root in that very context. Consider this. If the gospel writers or the early church had invented Jesus' resurrection, would they have made women the first eyewitnesses to the fact? No. They would have made men the heroes and the witnesses. Choosing women as the first eyewitnesses would have been laughable to the Middle Eastern mind, making the account less acceptable. The gospel authors would have had no incentive to write that account unless that's how it actually happened, and they were wanting to write what actually happened. A little bit more on this point. Mark chapter 6 tells us that Jesus, quote, could do no mighty work in Nazareth. At first blush, that seems to limit Jesus' power. Why would you include that? Matthew 24, 36, Jesus says he doesn't know the day or hour of his own return. That seems to limit his omniscience. Why would that be included? Mark 1, 9 says Jesus was baptized when he had no sin. That raises questions. I myself have been asked, I'm sure some of you have too, why is Jesus getting baptized? Why is that included? Jesus cries out at the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? That raises a lot of questions. Why are we including that? If we're trying to create a narrative that people will believe and that doesn't have any roadblocks to faith, why would you include things like that? If I'm going to invent a religion, why would I say, quote, be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect? Why would I say that adultery can be committed even in the heart? Those are hard things. The logical explanation is, obviously, that they were including all this information, embarrassing, inconvenient, damaging, hard to explain, roadblocks to faith, because their goal was to record what actually happened. Now, I've got another section I want to go to. Any comments or questions before we move on to that? Could those who are willing to help pass out? Thanks, Bill. We're going to move on to supposed contradictions. We're just going to get our feet wet, I guess, tonight. One of the most common types of differences among the gospel parallels is variation in quotation. And this is regarded as contradictory by people who are skeptical of the Bible, of the gospels. They'll say, well, look, those Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John claim to be historical accounts, but they don't agree with each other. And one example is they'll have Jesus saying, Mark has him saying one thing, Matthew has him saying another, and John has him saying another. And I've got the example here, first of all. Remember, Jesus told the parable of the sower, and later on that day, his disciples come to him, and they say, why do you speak to the people in parables? And Jesus explained why he spoke in parables, and then he did something for the apostles he never did for anybody else. He told them what the parable meant. And he starts out by telling them what the seed in the good ground represented. And that's what I've got here. And section A is the first section of the verse that describes this. Section B is the second section. So let's start. Let's read the first line of section A and section B. Matthew 13, 23. Jesus said, but he who receives seed on the good ground is he who hears the word and understands it. Section B, who indeed bears fruit and produces, some 100-fold, some 60, some 30. Of the exact same event, Mark writes, Mark 4:20, but these are the ones sown on good ground, those who hear the word and accept it, and bear fruit, some 30-fold, some 60, and some 100. Luke records of this event, but the ones that fell on the good ground are those who, having heard the word with a noble and good heart, keep it and bear fruit with patience. Now, we are so used to these sorts of things. If you're like me, you probably hadn't even given these things a whole lot of thought. You just read the stories, you know there are parallel accounts, and you just try to draw the truth from all the accounts and blend them together and walk away with it. And that is how they were intended to be used. But let's say you're on the outside looking in, and you've had someone, you've been reading the Gospels, and you're kind of intrigued by them, and then one of your buddies, who's not a believer, says to you, well, have you ever noticed how different these things are? Take, for example, this. Supposedly, these are biographies telling us what Jesus said, but he says something different in every one. What are some of the differences? I mean, I'm just going to ask an obvious question, but let's just look at this. I noticed that in Matthew 13, 23, it starts out with, but he, so it's singular, but Mark 4:20, it's but these, plural. Same way with Luke 8, 15. So Matthew's got Jesus speaking in the singular, Mark and Luke have Jesus speaking in the plural. One of them has Jesus speaking in, two of them have Jesus speaking in the present tense. One of them has him speaking in the past tense. In all of them, it mentions the good ground and the word. But notice in Matthew 13, at the end of section A, it talks about him understanding it. In Mark, it's he accepts it. And in Luke, he says he hears it with a noble and good heart. These are not the same words. And the same thing with section B. We have Matthew and Mark talking about some 30-fold, some 60, and some 100, although they put them in different orders. And in Luke, there's no mention of it at all. It just says, with patience. What do you say? Let's look at the next one. Jesus is baptized. He comes up from the waters of baptism, and the Father speaks from heaven. In Matthew 3, it's, "This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased." Mark 1:11, "You are my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased." Luke 3:22, "You are my beloved Son in you I am well pleased." Now, the differences are not as striking. They're just pronouns, but they are different. And these are only two examples. We could cite many, many such examples from the Gospels like this. So there are multiple explanations. We might need to save the explanation for next week. Or not, I will see. But you could say, well, in the case of the first one anyway, well, Jesus told the same parable multiple times probably. And that's certainly possible. Definitely possible. However, when you look at these accounts, this does seem to be the same instance. So I don't think that's open to us in this case. Well, maybe when he was explaining the parable, he repeated himself in his explaining as we do in teaching, and he said it three different ways. Well, that's possible, but it seems a little strained. And God certainly didn't speak three times when Jesus rose from heaven, and the first time said you, and then this, and switched to pronouns. So none of those explanations seem to work in these cases. I can't leave this hanging, so I guess we need to talk about it. What we are seeing is the practice, the ancient practice of paraphrase. And I will admit, this changed the way I saw the Gospels a little bit. It hasn't changed what I believe. It hasn't changed the doctrine I find in them, but it has tweaked my view just a little bit. The ancients paraphrased. They did not have all the recording technology we have. They did not have the same expectations. Rightful quotation in the ancient world granted all kinds of freedom that we are not accustomed to. For example, as you go through ancient historians, they will take speeches, they will summarize them, they will condense them, they'll shorten them to fit their narratives. You can look at the works of Thucydides, Herodotus, Josephus, Xenophon, the writer of 1 Maccabees, and they all do this, and we see it in the Old Testament. For example, 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 2, David's thinking how he wants to build a temple. He says, "See now," he says to Nathan the prophet, "see now, I dwell in a house of cedar, but the ark of God dwells inside tent curtains." But then you go to 1 Chronicles 17:1, which is a parallel account, and David says, "See now, I dwell in a house of cedar." That's exactly the same. But then he says, "But the ark of the covenant of the Lord," it was ark of God in 2 Samuel, now it's the ark of the covenant of the Lord, "is under curtains." Little differences, but they are different. Truthful quotation to the ancient biographer did not require exact quotation. There were no quotation marks. Do you realize there were no quotation marks even in English until the 16th century? If you are a King James user, there are no quotation marks in your Bible. You ever notice that? Language affects how we think. When you decide that you're going to have quotation marks, that brings multiple rules. And we're used to them in the modern world, but this is a modern thing. So as soon as you put something between quotation marks, what are you indicating to the reader? That is exactly what they said. And if you leave even one word out, what are you supposed to do? All right, you put the ellipse right in there, right? And if you add a word or change a word, for example, maybe the quote was, "She went to the store," but that's what you put in, that's what it was said, but when you write it down, you say, "Becky went to the store." Well, what do? You put Becky in the place of she, so what are you supposed to do? You put it in brackets. We have all these rules, but these are all modern rules. In the ancient world, they did not live by any of these. So long as what the author wrote was faithful to the original in meaning, the author was free to phrase his report however he liked. No one was going to accuse him of misquoting his source or producing an unreliable narrative. So they sought to retain in the Gospels the ipsissima vox, which is to say the very voice of Jesus, but they did not always include the ipsissima verba, the actual words. And as by way of example, we do this all the time. Don't we? I've got a child I send, go ask mom, blah, 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 blah. And come back and tell me what she says. Child goes, comes back, and I say, what did mom say? And I've got one particular child who by nature's just got a lot of desire for exactitude. I don't remember her exact words. It's okay. Just tell me what she said. And then he gives me his rendition. I know what she said, even though I didn't get the exact words. We function on this level all the time. And the reality is that ancient historians operated on this level, and that's what we're seeing in the Gospels. None of those instances that we look at changed the root. And they were written knowing that the others were written also, so they're meant to be taken in total. That's one other thing to keep in mind. When the Gospel writers were writing, they knew that the others had written or were writing as well. These were all meant to be taken as a whole. So I've used up my time. I appreciate your attention.